Author Greg Hammond's book, Mystic Seduction, Awakening Christians to a Real and Present Danger, addresses a growing concern he has had for several years, namely the steady shift and drift away from Christianity and toward a mystical, non-Christian theology and doctrine best described as monism. Under the guise of achieving a higher spirituality, practices derived from pagan and Eastern mysticism are being introduced and encouraged among Christians. The ultimate goal behind this seductive takeover of Christian belief is to move Christian theology toward Eastern and Gnostic concepts, thus preparing it for the merger of all faiths into a single worldwide religion. Stay tuned for my interview with Greg Hammond next, here on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. You can subscribe to this program on iTunes. And if you do, please leave us a review and a rating. That helps us. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad. And, of course, on our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. Greg Hammond holds a bachelor's degree in history and a master's degree in social sciences. Along with his wife Shannon, he currently works as a college campus minister. In addition to his campus responsibilities, he is an ordained minister and currently pastors a non-denominational independent church. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Greg.
Thank you, Mike. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you for accepting the invitation. I really appreciate your book, Mystic Seduction. We met at a conference last year, and so I heard you speak briefly about your research that that is in the book, and I knew immediately that I wanted to have you on the show. So I wonder if you would start off by sharing with our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, how you came to faith in Christ.
Yeah, well, you know, I've always kind of had, you know, spiritual sensitivity my whole life, and when I got to be 16 years of age, I believe it was, you know, I professed my faith in Jesus Christ, and probably like a lot of people, mostly out of fear of going to hell, you know, and I didn't want to go there. So, but the problem was with me in my life was that from age 16 to age 29, I pretty much left it there. So I didn't really study the Bible much, and didn't really know a lot about what was there. And so my life, you know, wasn't real God-centered, you know, for that 13 or so years. And then when I was about 29 years old, through doing a Bible study, adult Bible study with actually with my parents, that I really started growing in my faith and really started walking with the Lord, and which led me ultimately into full-time ministry. But I think one of the things about that 13-year period was I would have professed myself as a Christian. However, when I look back at some of the beliefs that I had, because I was, for the most part, biblically illiterate, they were really more in line with New Age Christianity than they were the truth, and primarily because, you know, my belief system was based upon my own personal emotion and feelings as opposed to truth. And so looking back at that, you know, I can see a lot of myself in what I'm now opposing because of just, you know, my lack of Bible knowledge and my desire really to walk with the Lord. So, and I taught high school for several years. I was a history teacher and made a vocational change about 17 years ago into full-time ministry. And I tell you what, I love serving the Lord and teaching His Word and defending the faith wherever I can. So I'm really enjoying my work. The book that I wrote is a book that you'd really rather not have to write, but I think it was necessary. So God prompted me to do that. Several people were telling me for several years, I've spoken on this topic, small groups and so on. They said, you need to be writing a book. So finally I said, okay, I'll give it a try and see what happens. And that's it's Mystic Seduction.
Yeah, well, you did great. It's a very, very well-researched and very clearly stated book, and I commend you on that, Greg.
Thank you.
Campus ministry and pastoring a church, I have to ask, and this is for my own curiosity, which one's the bigger challenge?
Well, you know, they both have their challenges. I really think that if I had to really break it down, probably campus ministry might be the bigger challenge. And I think the reason why maybe is because so many young people today, you know, are under 30 age, and especially your college age kids, 18 to 22, nowadays, you know, have grown up basically in a postmodern era where there's no certainty, truth is relative, and so I think they've really been immersed in that even without really realizing it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start talking about the Bible and teaching the Bible, you get into, you know, a lot of questioning attitudes about, you know, well, is that truth or is that someone's opinion, and how did the Bible even come about, and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, the church, you know, that most of the people, and my pastor church is really an older congregation, you know, they're pretty much, they know, understand the Bible is the Word of God and is true and can be proved to be so. But with the younger generation, it can be a challenge. Even just in the 18 years I've been a campus minister, I've seen changes in the thinking attitude of young people.
Oh, I imagine. Was it... Greg, was it at least in part your experiences with campus ministry and all of the different views and ideas and opinions that college-age kids exhibit? Did that play a part in you being motivated to write your book, Mystic Seduction?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, I think that seeing... you know, where they're at on things and or where they should be, but they're not, I think it just definitely motivated me to say, okay, someone's got to take note of this and call attention to this, because you know, and when you look, when you think about, you know, the kids today, you know, that are in their 20s and 30s and late teens, you know, they're in the next 20 years, they're going to be the leaders of the church.
That's right.
And so what they believe is going to dictate what the church is like. And like, you know, the talk I did up there at the Calvary Chapel, the conference you referred to, you know, my approach is more, it's polemics, which, you know, apologetics is the church's explanation to non-believers why we believe what we believe.
Yes.
But polemics is making sure the church understands what it believes and that's the truth.
Yeah.
And so we need to defend ourselves of what we believe in order so that when we project to a non-believing world, we're projecting the truth and not some skewed version of it. And that's my concern, is that we're getting to this point with a lot of this postmodern thinking coming in and mystical thinking coming into the church that what we may be projecting in the next few years and maybe really is already being projected from a lot of angles is something other than the truth.
Yes, that's right. Well, I think what you've described here is very easily captured in this idea, and you and I share the same theological viewpoint as far as eschatology and end times. Mm-hmm. And so your experiences with all of the different ideas and opinions, I think this it really is a melding, if you will, of different religious viewpoints, and I think we're being prepared to see the emergence of a one world religion. And just as soon as you say that and you use that term, I know there are a lot of Christians roll their eyes when they hear people talk about, you know, the end times one world religion. It's like, okay, here we go again. You know, there's doom and gloom, but why do we see such nativity among American Christians when it comes to the danger of mysticism that you describe in your book?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think first of all, I mean, you know, people say, you know, well, I don't believe there's going to be a one world government, one world religion. Well, I think there's tons of evidence to the contrary.
Yes.
And I believe that, you know, and I touch on this a little bit in the talk and in the book that I'm about ready to release, hopefully in the next month, is talks more about this a little bit. But I think that, you know, you look at religious problems in the world historically, some of the greatest bloodshed has been shed in wars that are religious and of religious nature. And, you know, different religion viewpoints, whether it be Muslims against Hindus in India and Pakistan or Jews and Muslims in the Middle East, whatever you want to talk about. And so I think that even in nations today, they want to solve these religious problems because they create such a problem internally for any nation that has religious strife. And I believe that this coming one world government that's on its way will understand that unless they eradicate the religious problems on the face of the earth, there's never going to be world peace, at least as they would define peace.
Yes.
And I think that's when you look at the book of Revelation and we see the Antichrist who has as his right-hand man, the false prophet, who's going to be heading up this religious system, tells us that that's important because, you know, the Apostle John didn't identify who is going to be his economic advisor or anything else, but he does identify who's going to be the head of the false religion because that's an issue.
Yeah.
Now, why Christians don't understand that or why they're naive about that, I think, you know, there's probably a lot of reasons. I think one of the problems, at least here in the United States, is I think Christianity is so steeped in materialism that, you know, people are more interested in their day-to-day lives and what they have or don't have instead of spiritual things. But I think, you know, some people just, they're scared of that, so they want to bury their head in the sand and figure that if they ignore it, it'll go away.
Right.
I think some people are just kind of lazy. You know, I think that's probably the root of I'm appalled sometimes at the biblical illiteracy of people who are Christians within the church.
Yes.
And I think, you know, that we study is like school. It's hard work, and you need to put the time in, and people don't want to. And I found, too, I think it seems like Christians are more likely to read self-help books by even non-Christian authors than they are reading the Bible.
Oh, boy, yeah. We're gonna touch on that in just a moment, but you're absolutely right, Greg. One of the things that I find baffling is that most Christians, if you gave them this statement and ask for their response, I think we would be disappointed in the response. And here's the question: is the Bible and what it claims an exclusive claim? And if it is exclusive, then that means every other belief system in the world is false. And if you would ask that question, pose that in a question, and then ask most Christians, is that true or false? Most of them would say it's false, that Christianity is not exclusive, that it does not mean that every other belief system in the world is false, but it really is exclusive, isn't it?
Yes.
And based on the claims of the Bible, if they are true, then that means other belief systems are false. And so Christians don't understand that. So I guess by way of explanation or definition, as we launch into your book, Greg, explain for us what Christian theism is, first of all, and then what monism is and the difference between those two.
Yeah, well, basically, you know, when you look, you know, there's all kinds of world religions, and but basically, you know, the boils down, there's really only two religious systems in the world, and it looks different on the outside, I guess, in from place to place, but theism basically is the idea that there's a person, God,
yes,
that has existed forever, and that he called creation, which is all of men and everything, into being. He's always existed,
yeah,
and he called creation into being, and there's separation between creator and creation,
yes,
so that they don't overlap, they're not one and the same. If you drew like two, it'd be like, look like two circles. One circle represented creation, then the other circle would represent God, and the God circle would be completely outside of creation, and
yes,
the creation is totally dependent upon the creator. In opposition to that is monism, which basically is real religion, or monistic, but it would be represented by one circle, meaning that the circle represents God and all of creation, or in other words, everything is God. And what that basically is Hinduism. The chair you're sitting in is God. You are God.
Yes.
When you look in the mirror, you see God, and
yes,
and because all is one, no separation between creation and creator.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, some of the proponents today, these are well-known names, and I'm just going to throw these out there for folks, and it might shake them up a little bit, but that might be a good thing. New Age spiritualists today, proponents of what you've just described as monism, that God is in all things, sort of a pantheistic,
mm-hmm,
panentheistic worldview.
Right.
Oprah Winfrey,
mm-hmm,
Rob Bell, who,
mm-hmm,
who at one time was a pretty well-known evangelical Orthodox,
yep,
Christian, and
mm-hmm,
he's anything but that today, of course.
Yep.
Deepak Chopra,
mm-hmm,
all of the, and we could go on and on and on, but those folks and the path that they have mapped out for Christians and encouraged Christians to go down, I think it's done great harm to the Church of Jesus Christ. Now, one of the things that I appreciated about your book, Greg, was that you added in some apologetics, you added in some logic, and
mm-hmm,
and I see those as tools to help believers answer the objections that they're going to receive from people. And so one of the things that you took the time to explain was the law of non-contradiction. And
mm-hmm,
how can the law of non-contradiction help Christians to see the errors in monism?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, you know, when you read the Bible is very clear that God is a God of order and not disorder.
Yes.
You know, he's very orderly in everything he does, and he's not random, disjointed, irrational, which really all those words describe monism and New Age thinking.
Yeah.
But and I believe too that man being made in the image of God, part of that is that God's given us a logical, rational, operating mind in the way that we think.
Yes.
And so what the law of non-contradiction is basically, to give you this, to simplify, let's take the math equation 2 + 2, okay?
Yeah.
You know, we all know 2 + 2 = 4, okay? Well, if you have two people here and you're asking them, well, what does 2 + 2 =? One of them could say, well, 2 + 2 = 3. And the other one may say, no, 2 + 2 = 5. Well, they're both wrong. You know, they're,
yes,
they're, you know, so there's no contradiction there. I mean, they're both wrong. Or, you know, the same two people could both come up with the right answer, 2 + 2 = 4, and they would both be right, no contradiction there. But when one of them says 2 + 2 = 3, and the other one says, no, 2 + 2 = 4, only one of them can really be right.
That's right.
And if there's contradiction, then there's a problem. You know,
yes,
it's not logical.
Right, right. Yeah, that's
so
right.
But the problem is like when you look at monism and New Age thinking, there's contradiction all over the place. and they never even attempt to explain why that is or how to get around it.
I heard one guy, Greg, I was talking to him about this, and he told me, well, but this is Buddhist logic. We don't have to make sense.
Yeah,
I just looked at him. I couldn't believe that he had just really reached out of the air and pulled that one an excuse. But
right.
But most Americans, though, they've got at least a cursory understanding of mystic practices. They're somewhat familiar with some of the phrases, such as an altered state of consciousness, for mm-hmm. example. That they're familiar at least with the phrase, if not with what the real meaning of it is. Now, practitioners of mysticism who attempt to achieve an altered state of consciousness, that's not really the end game, though. As bad as that is, the end game for practitioners of mysticism really is the reception of secret knowledge, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, the idea, you know, with meditation and, you know, within the Christian realms, there's a lot of different, you know, names they give it, contemplative prayer, centering prayer. That's what Oprah likes to use that a lot. But basically, it's employing a method of meditation by which you, for the most part, are trying to get your brain to check out. You're trying to achieve what they call the silence. You're trying to, as you said, enter into an altered state of consciousness. And usually, what they're trying to achieve, and this is, I think, can be measured too. They've done this scientifically, but like, achieve the alpha waves, which is basically renders the practitioner in a dreamlike state where they're still aware of what's going on. But what they're driving at, not just the experience of having an altered state of consciousness, but what they're wanting to do is have their mind and their being receptive to extrasensory messages that a lot of times they think they're from God, but in reality, they're coming from spirit guides or AKA demons.
yes, exactly. So just so our listeners are clear about this, meditation is an integral part of mysticism. Mm-hmm. But Christians can legitimately have mystical experiences as well, can't they?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And,
yeah, and that's the thing about it is, you know, I mean, I'm not, you know, it's not having a mystical experience, but really it's the source of the experience. That's the critical thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and when you look in the Bible, I mean, there are mystical experiences. You know, when Paul met the risen Savior on the road to Damascus, he was having a rather mystical experience.
That's right.
Or when Elijah, after his post-Mount Carmel experience, you know, where he heard, you know, God in a small, still whisper. I mean, that was a pretty mystical experience. And so mystical experiences aren't in and of themselves bad, but the key thing, I think, is like who or what initiates the experience. And when you look in the Bible, every mystical experience that's listed there, with the exception of maybe Saul and his encounter with the witch of Endor, it's initiated by God. You know, God is the one who's doing the initiating, and then, you know, we're responding. And that's the way God works. You know, he, even with Jesus Christ, you know, God initiated to fallen man through Jesus Christ, and we respond to the gospel message. But in the case of the bad mysticism, I call it, is man initiating the experience himself. And what is happening, basically, is when God initiates the experience, we're safe because God's in control.
Yes.
But when man initiates the experience, man is no longer in control, because what he's done is dropped his defenses and allowed someone else to control the experience, and that is demons, really.
Yes, that's right. And we'll touch on that a little bit later in the show, too. You mentioned the Olivet Discourse and suggested, and I thought rightly, that Jesus was attempting to warn us about these end times mystical experiences. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Jesus was wanting the disciples, obviously, to know the signs of the ends of the age. I think, you know, that message, personally, I believe it was more for our generation than that generation at the time he was getting ready to go to the cross.
Yeah.
But I think what he was telling us, you know, is he wanted everybody, us to know what to be looking for so we knew when the time of his return was near. And one of the things that he said in that teaching time was that many would come in his name, you know,
yes,
professing to be the Christ. And he warned the disciples that, you know, different people would appear to be the Christ and say, go out there or go to this room or whatever, that we found the Christ. And he made it clear that he would return in the clouds and catch us up to be with him forever. And so don't go chasing after these false Christs. Well, what is interesting is that, you know, when I used to read this, I used to think like, well, you know, there's all types of antichrists that have been around. You know, you can look at Hitler, Antiochus Epiphanes, or, you know, the Roman Caesars. But, you know, and I thought, yeah, they're a type of antichrist. But I think what he was talking about was something bigger than that. And the reason why is because the Greek word for many is the word polis, which means literally millions.
Yes.
And so what Jesus was saying is there would actually be millions upon millions upon millions of people coming in his name.
Yes.
Not just a few people.
Yeah.
And so I think what he was talking about was exactly what this mysticism is driving at, is this idea that the Christ consciousness, that
yes,
every person potentially can become a Christ. There's no the Christ like Jesus was. He was the Christ, the only one.
Yes.
But that anybody can become a Christ and understand that they are God, which is what Christ consciousness basically means, through meditative mystical practices.
Yes, yes. And that's one of the things that we hear often from those who are practicing New Age religion, Hinduism, Buddhism, is that we all have a divine spark within mm-hmm. us, and the real problem for humanity is that we've forgotten who we are, and we need to rediscover that. Now, I find it interesting that as we're talking tonight, Greg, that a certain pastor, and I'll be kind, pastor has released a book, and I believe the title is something to the effect of The Power of I Am, or something of that nature.
Uh-huh.
I think that plays right into where American spirituality is heading today, in that we need to understand the divinity within us. And that's a scary thing, to see mm-hmm. pastors, prominent pastors, coming out and really coming alongside of this whole idea of the Christ yeah. consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
How does mysticism then fit into the push for this global religion that we talked about a few moments ago?
Yeah. Well, I think that the way it's going to fit in is, as I see mystical practices and mysticism being the great adapter to allow different contradictory religious systems to merge into one basic religious, you know, global worldwide religion. And
yeah.
I think the way that's going to happen is that, you know, you talk about spiritual syncretism, and I think that's a big issue, but it's that basic idea that contradictory viewpoints aren't really contradictory, you know, even
right.
though we know they are.
Right.
But what they teach is that on the outside, in the physical world, which most of them would say is an illusion anyway,
yes.
We look differently, but at the core, we're all the same, and at the core, we're all God. And so once we understand that, then we will become tolerant of our differences, because really we're all the same anyway.
Yes.
And what mysticism does, the mystical practices, is what enables us to come to that realization that, okay, you're a Buddhist and you're a Hindu and I'm a Christian, but if we really would meditate and think about this and let God really speak to us, we realize that we're really one and the same anyway. And so why why be divisive? Let's just join together and you know, form that global village.
Yes, yes. And if listeners will spend a few moments and think about that, I think they can figure out just how scary a scenario that would present. Because in effect, what they're saying is, let's just discard our own distinct propositional truth, and let's just all focus on our own subjective and experiential truth. Mm-hmm. And I think that really opens folks up for mass deception, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And you know, I think too, you know, that a person technically really, they don't have to practice a mystical practice to be a mystic. Really the main thing, and this is what the Satan really wants, is just you accept the fact that that's truth, and then you no longer, you know, stand for biblical truth because you think that's the real truth, and then you just you move on. And what I think is interesting too, you know, as we talked earlier about theism and monism, these two different systems, and the three theistic religions in the world are, of course, Christianity, but also Judaism and Islam. But what's interesting, I found, is that within each of these traditions, and we're talking about the mystical brand of Christianity, but there's also a mystical brand of Islam and a mystical brand of Judaism, you know.
That's right.
Judaism is Kabbalah, and Islam is Sufism. And when you look at those three systems and what they teach and how they promote you finding out the truth about your spiritual identity, they're virtually identical.
Yes.
And they're all almost identical to Hinduism and Buddhism.
Yes. You made a very astute observation, Greg, in your book on page 127. What really was in the context of talking about the role that governments, the U.S. government included, but governments are playing in destroying Christianity and in effect promoting these demonic false religions. You mentioned four things on 127. Do you want to cover those real quick?
Well, I don't have my book here. Can you just read those off, what they were?
Okay, sure. Yeah. Number one was the uniqueness of Jesus as both God and man must be eradicated.
Right.
Number two, the beliefs that set Christianity apart from paganism will be downplayed as bigoted exclusivism.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, the atonement that took place on the cross will be deconstructed as an unnecessary evil act, or its true meaning will be heretically redefined. And then finally, fourth, global spiritual syncretism must occur, merging the world's religions into one. All of those things are going on right now, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think you see that. And I think, you know, basically what has to happen, I think, for a global religion to come about is, I think, those four critical things, you know, about that really, you know, define what Christianity is. You know, the Jesus is God in the flesh. Are definitely being attacked, and I think they're not only being attacked through what you want to call them liberal Christian churches, but I think, you know, that governments are attacking them too. You look in our country right now, I mean, and without going into specifics, but you look at you know, some of the rulings the Supreme Court's made on some things. You know, I think, you know, for example, a pastor starting to run a risk now of, depending upon what they're preaching on, of it being considered, you know, hate speech or whatever, but
yeah.
Or you can look at you know, what's being promoted through education, for example. You know, the World Core curriculum that's, you know, coming out of the United Nations that's being pushed,
yes,
in our schools now under the guise of Common Core curriculum.
Yes.
You know, which is there's a spiritual. It's scary, you know. I mean, that basic teaching that was formulated in the World Core curriculum, you know, comes out of the occult, you know, out of Alice Bailey's teachings, and it's really scary, and you know, that's being promoted in our public education, and the media, you know, you look at the media, how skewed it is, and mm-hmm. the stories they will report on or they won't report on, or you know, the list can just really go on and on. I mean, even something as really maybe unimportant as President Obama renaming Mount McKinley Mount Denali.
Right.
You know, that's I think what's going on too is just, you know, there's a total resistance against maybe Western culture in general, but Christianity in particular, because it's associated with Western culture so much that let's get rid of it all because it's not good for us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a very ancient foe of Christianity is gaining a renewed strength today, and I'm talking about Gnosticism. Now, it never really left the scene. It was very low key for many, many years, but there has always been practitioners of Gnosticism, but it seems like it's on the rise again now. What is Gnosticism exactly, Greg, and what is it teaching today?
Well, you know, basically to simplify, because when you study about Gnosticism, you know, it emerged, you know, within Christianity and immediately upon, you know, after as the church was growing, immediately Satan started attacking the church through Gnosticism and people who were promoting that, claiming to be Christians, but it was anything but. It was really paganism disguised as Christianity. But basically what Gnosticism comes from the Greek word gnosis, which is knowledge, and what it promotes is hidden knowledge. And of course the word hidden is also another word used for that is occult.
Yes, so that's right.
We're looking for what it's based in is occult knowledge, and it's really what we've been talking about. It's through meditating practices the Gnostics believe that they could eventually achieve what the early skewed church, the Gnostic church, called union with God. In other words, becoming God.
Yes.
And so, and one of the challenges with Gnosticism in the first and second century was that they were doing what is going on today in the church. They would give passages of the scripture new meanings. They would take it out of context. They would change the meanings of words. And in fact, like, you know, Irenaeus and Tertullian, early church fathers, you know, were commenting because they were battling the Gnostics in those first two centuries. And this is the thing they were saying was making it very hard to battle, because on the outside they appeared to be Christians, but they were anything but.
Yes.
And so we're seeing that today. And, you know, some of the people you mentioned, you know, their views, like I think you mentioned, like Rob Bell, for example. I mean, that's kind of what he's promoting, the same basic view. And now he wouldn't call himself a Gnostic, and nobody would, but he's really kind of promoting that.
Yeah. The Gnostics held some beliefs that were contradictory to and really antithetical to Christianity. For example, that historic Christianity was completely wrong, that Jehovah was not who we think he is, that that really Lucifer was the good one, that Jesus never claimed to be God, that he merely attained a higher conscious awareness of himself. Yeah. I mean, all of those things. And we see that rearing its head again today, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah. So, philosophically speaking, Neoplatonism also is found a home. And you give some good research on Pseudo-Dionysius and the role that this writer played in the emergence of mysticism in the church. Can you walk us through some of that?
Yeah, well, you know, Neoplatonism, of course, it was neo meaning new, sort of like the new Platonism, was based in the philosophy of the Greek philosopher Plato, who was pretty much, you know, secular in his viewpoint. But it's like Plato's views spiritualized, and basically it was introduced into the Christian church primarily by Pseudo-Dionysius in the 3rd, 4th centuries. And what Neoplatonism promoted is that there was what they called the absolute one, which was one God. Everything was God. You know, there's nothing that really isn't God. All creation was God. And so Pseudo-Dionysius, who was supposedly the Dionysius that's mentioned in the book of Acts, but obviously he wasn't. That's why they called him Pseudo-Dionysius.
Right.
But anyway, so, and what he basically promoted was that we were to seek our true self or our higher self through meditative practices with the end goal of achieving union with God, which is basically the point at which you realize that you and God are the same. And in paganism, they call that the seeing with the mystical eye or the third eye. But basically, it's the idea that you understand that, that you're God, or you and God are one and the same. And so they use these practices to what they call the contemplative path, yes, in order to try to achieve that idea. I mean, and the thing about it is like from Pseudo-Dionysius' standpoint, man's biggest problem was not his sin nature, which as we know is from Christian standpoint, that's the issue.
Yes.
But the issue was the fact that you have forgotten who you are.
Yes.
And the solution to your problem was remembering who you were through mystical practices.
Yes, yes. Interestingly, they did hold up Christ as the example, but they held him up in a wrong context. They they denied that he was the second person of the Trinity, for example, and instead claimed, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Greg, you've done the research, that that Christ really was an emanation from the One.
Yes.
And who managed to discover the source of his being. He came from the One, and so he became an illuminated being.
Yes, and what Jesus became, you know, they would teach that, you know, that I think the way they put it was like that the Son God, you know, this emanation descended on him at his baptism, you know.
Yes.
But that basically what Jesus was, he was a man who became a Christ, not the Christ, but and he wasn't always the Christ. You may know that Jesus always been and always will be the Christ.
Yes.
But you know, he became the Christ, and then he became what in Hinduism they would call an avatar. Mm-hmm. And what an avatar is, or sometimes they would call it a wayshower, it's someone who has realized that they're God, mm-hmm, but instead of moving on into union with God and basically ceasing to exist, they turn back into the world in order to show other people the true way out of their deception.
Yes, yeah. One of the things that contemplative mysticism teaches as well is that Jesus is not necessary for salvation.
Right.
Because we save ourselves. Is that, mm-hmm, is that
exactly
accurate?
Right.
Yeah. Part of the way that, that we accomplish that, according to the contemplative spirituality, contemplative mysticism, is through a threefold contemplative path. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. The threefold path, and this is what Pseudo-Dionysius came up with as his version of salvation, of self-salvation. The first step was basically what he called purgation, which one was, in essence, purifying themselves through the mystical practices of meditation, whatever form that they had decided to pursue. And the goal was, as they went into this mystical practice, they would eventually come to the second stage or step, which was illumination, which is, you know, the throwing light on something that was in the dark otherwise. In other words, the realization about something. And what one discovered in that second step was that their true spiritual identity was that they were God. And that led then to the third and final stage, which I've already mentioned a couple of times, of union with God. And that's where they would become one with what Neoplatonism called the Absolute One, or what the Christian Gnostics called God. But nonetheless, man is God. And so, as we've already stated, sin wasn't the issue; it was spiritual forgetfulness.
Yeah.
And one of the ways, the key ways that Pseudo-Dionysius recommended that this be done was he basically said to leave behind the senses and intellect, which basically means emptying your mind and ceasing thought, so that you can hear from the what he called the celestial hierarchy, which were angels or, you know, fallen angels.
Yes, right. Yes. Well, Vatican II provided a huge shot in the arm.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that was the intention, but it certainly was the result, in that it increased an openness, at least within the Roman Catholic Church, for interfaith dialogue, and that's led to an increase in mystical practices, hasn't it?
Yes. Yes, I think, you know, when Angelo Roncalli became Pope John the 23rd, 1958, I remember reading, I think I've related it in the book, you know, he was really old, and so everybody was expecting him just to be status quo and probably last a few years and then be exit this life, and then they install another one. But he really shocked the world whenever he, you know, called for the Second Vatican Council or Vatican II, and declared really a new Pentecost. And when you think about what happened at the first Pentecost, you realize that he's kind of like calling a new church into being, which I think that's what it's kind of led to, because this opened the door to interfaith dialogue with non-Christians and basically the acknowledgement that there's at least some truth in other religions, and so that needed to be explored. And even though this was the Catholic Church, you know, this impacted a lot of Protestants as well, and even non-Christians who, you know, like Hindus, who realized all of a sudden that the Christians were open to their views on things, wanted to enter into that dialogue. And so you had a lot of the Catholic priests and monks and so on, you know, like Thomas Merton, that, you know, were really jumping in on this and taking advantage of this, and this promotion of mysticism, Eastern style mysticism in the church. And so and I think what's interesting is that fit really well, because the era of the 1960s was also the time of the cultural revolution. Yes. In the United States, you know, with the hippie movement and everything, which was a spiritual movement. Yes. And so you combine all these things together, and you've got a recipe for disaster, I guess, for the church.
Yes, yes. You mentioned Thomas Merton. I'm going to throw a couple of other names out here for our listeners, and I'm not suggesting that they go read their material. In fact, I'm suggesting they don't. But these individuals, and this is just a few of many that were instrumental in introducing mysticism into the Christian Church. Thomas Merton, of course, a Roman Catholic priest. Richard Foster, in his, I think, Celebration of Disciplines was his book, I believe.
Right.
The late Dallas Willard. Leonard Sweet. Now, I happen to know a little bit about Sweet. I did my doctoral dissertation on he and Rob Bell, Brian McLaren, and their emergent theologies. And so I thought I'd share a quote from Sweet in his book, Quantum Spirituality. It's on page 181 in the book that you wrote, Greg. And he's being quoted here, in fact, by Carl Rayner. But he says this, Sweet says this. He says, "Mysticism, once cast to the sidelines of the Christian tradition, is now situated in postmodernist culture near the center." In the words of one of the greatest theologians of the 20th century, and that statement there says a mouthful about Sweet. But he says, in the words of one of the greatest theologians of the 20th century, Jesuit philosopher of religion, dogmatist Karl Rayner, "The Christian of tomorrow will be a mystic, one who has experienced something, or he will be nothing. Mysticism is metaphysics arrived at through mind-body experiences. Mysticism begins in experience, it ends in theology." Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what's interesting, the first thing he kind of notes, that Christianity for hundreds of years understood that what he's promoting is wrong because they cast it aside.
That's right.
And so he's really acknowledging that that's not historical Christianity, for starters, but he's basically acknowledging too that now they've seen the open door and it's entering in. So a lot of these guys kind of throw that out there like it's a correction, like they've had it wrong for the last 2,000 years and now they're finally getting it right. But they're really you know, just trying to introduce a whole new Christianity into the world. But I think it's exactly right. You know, mysticism is basically trying to arrive at, quote, truth, unquote, on your own. Yeah. And if, without guidance by the Bible and comparing things to the Bible, then you come up with what you believe to be your own truth, and therefore it becomes theology. You know, it becomes the truth for you. And I think that's exactly what's going on. And I think he's pegged it, you know, unfortunately, that it is front and center with a growing number of so-called Christians in this country and around the world.
Yes. Chapter 8 in your book, Greg, is entitled Mystic Methods, Mantras, and Meditation. Mm-hmm. And in Chapter 8, you tackle a hot topic today, and that is yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Christian yoga. Is that an oxymoronic phrase?
To me, it is.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It is to me, too. But
yeah,
what does yoga mean, and what is it really?
Well, you know, yoga is, you know, and I've locked horns with people on this because, you know, there's so many churches that actually introduce this.
Yeah.
And as something, one of the things their church offers to their parishioners, and it's promoted usually in the United States as a way to relieve stress and become more flexible, which they believe is healthy. And yeah, I think, you know, we want to relieve stress and we want to be more flexible. But what people don't understand is that there's really no separation between the exercise, the physical part of yoga, and the spiritual part. And just to give you an example of that, you know, Dr. Subhas Tiwari, who is a professor at the Hindu University, he made this bold statement. He said, yoga is Hinduism.
Yes.
He said he basically said you can't separate the two. When you're doing it, you're doing yoga. You're doing Hinduism. And so there's a spiritual, it's almost like a spiritual language when you go through the poses.
Yes.
And start into the meditation process, and there's plenty of examples. I think I cited one in the book there. You know, this guy that started out doing yoga just to relieve stress, yeah, and he wound up, you know, fully into it.
Yeah.
And what people don't understand too is that, you know, these poses and everything have a spiritual significance, and what yoga basically is driving towards, there's seven chakra points.
Yes.
Beginning at the base of the spine, going up to the crown of the head, and each level that you move up in the meditative process, as you go deeper into it, you're moving more towards this realization that you're God. And when you achieve the seventh and final chakra point, at the crown of the head, they consider you to be seeing with, like I mentioned earlier, the mystic eye or the third eye. And what that means is the realization that you and God are the same. And Sir John Woodruff, back in the 19th century, he was an expert on this and wrote a book called The Power of the Serpent. And basically, Hinduism, what they consider is at the base of every person's spine, there's a sleeping serpent that needs to be awakened. And as this serpent, through the meditative practices, is awakened, it uncoils up the spine through the seven chakra points, each step of the way moving you towards the realization that you're God. Now, the obvious thing to look at here, it's like we know what the deception of the serpent in the Garden of Eden was all about, is that Adam and Eve could become like God. Well, this is what the power of the serpent, you know, yoga is really driving towards. And so for a Christian to be practicing this, it's a grave concern. And even if they never really got to the point that they believed they were God, part of my point is like, how does practicing a pagan religion and a pagan, you know, contemplative practice like that glorify God?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, one final thought, and it really is a good wrap up to our conversation today, Greg. The last chapter in your book, chapter 9, is entitled Christian Mysticism Today: Pathway to the New Christians. And I just want to read this first paragraph, then mm-hmm. then I've got a comment, because okay. Because this is happening right before our eyes, whether people are picking up on it and connecting the dots or not. I certainly have, and this paragraph jumped off the page at me when I read it. It says, no matter how much one tries to twist and turn the word, ultimately there is no way around the fact that looming in the future is a modification in Christianity as we have known it. Now, I want the listeners to think about how many times you've heard Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and any other number of politician or world figures make this statement: you have to change your beliefs. Christians, mm-hmm. you have to change your beliefs. And what they're saying is you have to change in order to fit in to the new religion that's coming. And so let me finish this chapter. It says, This will become more and more evident as we near the return of Christ. Scripture is explicit about this. It tells us that the understanding of what Christianity truly is will be altered to the point that many will fall away from the truth and pursue a way that seems right to man, but in the end will lead to death. And of course, that's from Proverbs 14, 12. You have a comment on that, Greg?
Well, I believe that really sums it up. I think, you know, that the world on a global scale, the main movers and shakers are, they have an agenda. And I think, you know, a lot of people say, well, there's no ulterior motives going on here, but I really believe there are.
Yes.
And I think, you know, they understand that, just like in Rome in the first and second centuries, you know, were a thorn in the side of the emperors because they wouldn't bow and declare Caesar as God.
Yes.
And I think, you know, that in these end times, I think Christians are going to be taking the same stand. And I think the world wants to either capture Christianity. I think that's what's really going on here. They'd like to capture Christianity by altering it.
Yes.
But if they can't, then they'd like to totally destroy it. And so anybody who stands up, you know, is creating a problem for them. And so I think, you know, but we all know that we are not to fear the one that can destroy the body, but the one that can destroy the body and the spirit, and that is God Almighty. And so
yes.
I'm putting my lot in with him.
Amen. Amen. Well, folks, we've been talking to author Greg Hammond about his book, Mystic Seduction, Awakening Christians to a Real and Present Danger. Greg, they can buy this book on your website. And what is that web address?
Yeah, it's www.bealertministry.com, all lowercase.
Okay. And do you have any other social media presence? You're on Facebook or Twitter?
Yeah.
Or any of those things?
Yeah, I have a Facebook page. I've never been big into Facebook. I try to keep up on it, but it is www.facebook.com/bealertministry/. So,
okay.
And then the book's also available, you know, in all the ebook stores and on Amazon as well.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, Greg, I appreciate the conversation. There's a lot there that we left, and maybe we'll have to loop back around and have another conversation about this topic. Thanks for being on Soaring Eagle, Greg. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me, Mike. It's been a pleasure.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, pastormike@woh.rr.com. God bless you today as you seek him.